My name's Paul Bestall, and you're listening to Mysteries and Monsters. The world is a possibility, if you'll only try. Welcome to Mysteries and Monsters. This week I am joined by one of the most knowledgeable members of the cryptozoological world, David Weatherly. David is someone whose work I first discovered when I read his first volume of Woodknocks about 3 years ago. The Woodknocks series, if you're not aware of it, is a compendium of essays that brings some of the best authors and researchers together under one cover to discuss Bigfoot and his international relatives. Throughout the three volumes so far, there's been contributions from Lyle Blackburn, Ken Gerhardt, Linda Godfrey, Richard Freeman, Nick Redfern, Micah Hanks, Lauren Coleman, Rosemary Ellen Guiley, Chris O'Brien and more. And I recommend it as an essential collection for anyone who loves cryptozoology. It's a great series of books, and David's got a volume 4 coming later on this year, which we discuss in the interview you'll hear in a short while. I think David deserves a great deal of recognition for pulling together such a talented roster of authors, and it's no small task, and that should tell you all you need to know about David's reputation in the cryptozoological field. So we dive in and we discuss his two latest books, which cover a myriad of cryptids from Arizona and Nevada, Copper State Monsters and Silver State Monsters, as well as the previous work and his upcoming releases. We had an interesting chat, notably due to our conversation suffering some kind of outside interference at a couple of points, which David jokingly referred to as the Men in Black joining in. But I suppose you know when you're doing something right, when weird stuff starts happening to yourself without you actually going out and looking for it. And this episode certainly was challenging on a technical aspect. So before we dive in, don't forget to follow us on Facebook, Twitter and Instagram, as well as subscribe to our YouTube channel where you can get all the episodes as well. You can also find me on Twitter and Instagram and Facebook under Paul Bestall. And also you can support us on Patreon for $1 a month too. Right, let's join David Weatherly on a quest for monsters. I'm delighted to be joined today by author, researcher and investigator David Weatherly. David's appetite for the mysterious is a dizzying and dazzling opportunity to showcase his abilities as a writer and a researcher, but also as an open-minded thirst for knowledge. He's released numerous books covering all kinds of paranormal subjects, including bringing the notorious black-eyed kids into the light, haunted objects, and also the fantastic Woodknocks series, which features a who's who of cryptozoologists. His two latest books focus on collecting stories of both cryptids and legends. Silver State Monsters covers Nevada, and the latest, Copper State Monsters, searches Arizona for such tales. David, I'm delighted to welcome you to Mysteries and Monsters today. Thank you.
Paul, it's a pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me on.
Oh, thank you. It's an absolute pleasure. Like I said in the introduction, I first came to know your work through the first volume of Woodknocks, and obviously I've followed your career ever since, and I've always been very impressed with your knowledge across a wide range of subjects, which seems to be equally well researched and investigated. I've heard you mention before that it was a chance meeting as a child with the cryptozoological legend Stan Gordon that kind of exploded your interest in that subject.
No, it wasn't Stan Gordon. Actually, I kind of got started on this stuff because of, I guess a natural inclination towards strange things, if you will. I grew up mostly as an only child. I do have one brother, but he was 10 years older. So, you know, he moved out fairly soon. And by the time, you know, I was just a young man. I was very fascinated by ghost stories and, you know, different legends and things like that. And bear in mind, you know, I was born in the 60s. So we're talking about the early 1970s, and these types of things were really not popular, as you would say. So, you know, it was, I guess maybe it was kind of my way of rebelling or something. I don't know. I grew up in a rural area, and the strange thing that happened for me was that a couple, an elderly couple, built a house very close to ours. I lived in the country, and this woman turned out to be a spiritualist. Now, at the time, the early 1970s, she was probably the only spiritualist in the eastern half of North Carolina, which is the state I was in. And, you know, she was a very fascinating person and, you know, talked about seances and table tapping and all these different types of things. And she was also the reason I found Fate magazine, which, you know, in this country was very legendary for being pioneering and getting all these different stories out and accounts of strange things from around the world. And once I discovered that, man, that was very eye opening. So, you know, from that time on, now the first really notable figure that I met in my career was John Keel. And Keel was a big influence on me just because, well, for a number of reasons. Of course, he was best known for writing the Mothman Prophecies. But, you know, Keel took a very journalistic approach. He was a prolific writer, obviously, and, you know, wrote for a lot of the magazines of the day on topics like UFOs and strange creatures. And, you know, Keel was very he took a very holistic approach. Which is something that I've always tried to do in my career, is look at a lot of different aspects. You know, over the years, a lot of people tried to segregate different strange phenomena and you know, it was, oh, okay, well, we're only studying UFOs. We don't look at cryptids or anything else, and, you know, vice versa. And I think you're really denying a lot of data if you start doing that. And denying the fact that there are areas of the world that have a whole conglomeration of strange things occurring.
I mean, that is probably the first book I read where he basically just looked at everything that was going on in one area, rather than just, you know, as you refer to, everybody always associates Keel with just the Mothman, but the book itself is just a wide variety of strange phenomena that was occurring in that area at the time.
It really is, and I've been to Point Pleasant a lot of times, and I can tell you it's still to this day a very, very strange place. And the range of reports that come out of that small little town is just kind of bizarre. You know, everything from haunted locations to modern UFO sightings. And, of course, you know, for anyone who's read Keel's work, they'll know that there are a lot of other things in that area aside from just the Mothman sightings. You know, the weird Indrid Cold encounters, UFOs, Men in Black, and a whole range of things. So, like I said, he was a big influence on me. And so were people like Jacques Vallée, you know, who just took a investigative / scientific approach, but also remained very open and realizing that, you know, we can't assume that we have the answers and that we can fit things into boxes. So that's what I make an effort to adapt that type of approach.
Yeah. I mean, obviously with the two latest books, for someone like me, who obviously hasn't been fortunate enough to visit those particular states in America, What was it that you decided, right, I'm going to do an overview of a particular state and then break it down into certain sections? Did you feel that was kind of missing from the Fortean Library at the current time?
I did. And, you know, I'm one of those people who I always have a whole range of projects that I'm working on at the same time. And what happened in this situation was that I have, as you can guess, having done this since the 70s, I had a massive amount of files and, you know, everything from news clippings to cases I've worked and so forth. And recently have started starting to go through those and trying to organize them. And when I was doing that, I wrote a piece on Sasquatch in Nevada for the Woodknot series. Mm. And when I had done that, I realized, wow, there's a lot of other things in Nevada too. And just sort of, you know, set all that stuff aside and said, you know, there's a whole book here, really. And I personally just found a lot of it fascinating. As a writer, sometimes, you know, you write things that you're passionate about, whether they're going to sell or not, I guess. I honestly wasn't sure whether people would respond to it or not. But Silver State Monsters, which came out at the beginning of this year, covers a lot of those things that I discovered in Nevada, and people have responded quite well to it. And there are some pretty fascinating legends in the state. It's, you know, some strange cryptozoological things, and then of course some other more folklore legends that have crossed over into the crypto world too.
Yeah, I mean, the one story that jumps out at me in the Silver State Monsters book is the story of Don Wood Jr.'s, I'm not really sure what we could describe it as, his experience with what he described as a flying clam. Yes. And I just found, I don't think I've ever come across anything that resembles that story in any other literature or report from anywhere in the world. What did you think when you first came across that?
Oh, you know, it was one of those accounts that I had to sit and read several times because, you know, you look at it, and you think it is, wow, really? but, you know, here's the interesting thing. You know, of course, these things are referred to as, you know, I refer to them as space clams in the book. And it probably is the strangest, most unusual piece that's in the Silver State Monsters. Mm. The account surfaced now in the 1950s, and what you have to remember is that it was published in a UFO-related publication, and during that time, it was a very different scene, if you will, in terms of how people looked at UFOs, and they weren't at that point locked onto this idea that every UFO that came down was full of little gray aliens with big eyes. Mm. So it's fascinating to look at some of that literature and read the accounts and the experiences that people are reporting, because you see a whole range of different types of craft and aliens being reported. Mm. The fascinating thing about this particular encounter is that this gentleman, he was a pilot, and he claimed that this encounter took place in 1925. Mm. And, you know, he said that he was flying in the desert, and he landed on this – of course, there's a lot of very wide-open land in Nevada even still. Mm. And he was flying solo in what was called a Jenny at the time. Mm. Those were very popular in the 1950s for amateur pilots. And he landed on this mesa that was, you know, very wide open area. It was part of Nevada that, of course, there weren't any, you know, houses or anything like that. Mm-hmm. And when he landed and got out of the plane, he witnessed this thing that he described as a giant clam. So essentially, he talks about seeing a living UFO. And it's not just one, but there are two of them. Mm. And so, you know, he sees these things and he gets this impression that one is sort of helping or, you know, feeding the other one almost. Mm. Because it has these sucker-like, what he called tongues, that come out of the larger craft and settle onto the smaller vehicle. And, you know, some other things that go on there, these pulsing lights. And then they suddenly take over at what he estimates is something like 1,000 miles an hour. You know, it's crazy how quickly they just dart off into the sky. And he sent his account into a magazine called Flying Saucers that was very popular at the time, 1950s. And it was published initially anonymously, but later on his name was revealed, and he talked about it a little bit more. But, you know, the things they've been described variously as space clams, as flying manta rays because of the shape and the strange things that they did. But, you know, this was one of a handful of cases that occurred around that time that people were convinced that UFOs were not spacecraft that had been built, but that they were some type of living creatures, perhaps from the upper atmosphere of our planet or perhaps from space itself.
Yeah, I mean, it is a very strange story, like you say, because there are so many particular facets of it that are very unusual. I mean, obviously, he mentions that the smaller one appears first of all and seems to be injured in some way or right. damaged, and it's leaking a strange substance, and it seems to be trying to communicate with them. It's just a baffling. And the other thing that made me smile was that obviously in his correspondence to the magazine, he says, "Oh yeah, I know what this is. It's this," as though he's absolutely convinced that, you know, they're not flying objects or anything, that they're some type of creature.
Right. And this comes from being in close proximity to this thing. And he does say, you know, curiously at the time, of course, that era, everyone was describing, for the most part, UFOs as flying saucers, you know, saying that they were saucer shaped. And he does say that this smaller creature, that it's, I think he said that it was somewhere around 8 feet, you know, in diameter, and that it was flat and shaped like a saucer, but that it was a living creature. And, you know, he describes his experience of being near these things and that they are living beings from the way they were acting and interacting and so forth. So it's quite fascinating. It's, you know, in some ways it's, if you can imagine, you know, the first explorer seeing in Africa, seeing an elephant or something like that, you know, here's this very large creature. He knows absolutely in his mind, he knows this is a living being and not some mechanical craft. So it's such a puzzling case. And of course it's also one that's very isolated. We just don't have any others or any follow-ups to it. But, you know, all the implications are that this gentleman, he didn't make the experience up. There was no reason for him to, and certainly no value in doing so.
Yeah, it seems to not have the typical tropes that you associate with stories at that time, because, you know, there was a lot of, you know, we're able to look back at that period with quite a great deal of hindsight, and we look at, you know, Adamski's visitors from Venus and people right. who were communicating from certain planets, which we've now learned, you know, science and the space exploration has given us a completely different insight to what we actually know about our universe compared to what perhaps people knew in the 50s, where maybe you could try and pull the wool over people's eyes. But Wood's story just is baffling in its originality, if anything.
It really is, and it's fascinating in that he didn't try to capitalize on it in any way, which I find kind of compelling, because as you just stated, you know, during that period we had so many contactees, you know, people were forming these little saucer groups, you know, space brother organizations, and you know the friendly aliens, Nordic aliens from Venus or wherever, were going to come down and save us all. And, you know, you had all these strange things occurring, but this is, again, a very isolated case that is just bizarre.
It is. It's fascinating to me. And I think it's one of those subjects that it's probably the tip of the iceberg. I mean, one of the key aspects of your work is that you tend to do a lot of research in the newspapers of the time and the literature that was available at the era. Like you refer to, I think the general consensus has got to sort of in the 80s and 90s that UFOs, everything was little green men. But Wood's story is one of those, like Flatwoods, Chestnut Ridge, where the witnesses describe something that doesn't fit in that particular cliched description of a UFO and its occupants, as it were.
That's right. It's within its own paradigm somehow, and you know, as researchers were left just not sure what to do with that.
Do you think that's probably why people left that story alone, because it is so strange?
Well, possibly. I think, you know, additionally, it didn't receive a whole lot of attention. I mean, you have to realize that it was initially published in the letters section of Flying Saucers, and there was just so much coming out at that time, and the focus was on the contactee movement and, you know, the friendly aliens that were coming down. Mm. So really, I think that the dominant interest at that time was, oh, the Nordic Space Brothers or whatever, you know, and the people, of course, all the people claiming to have gone for rides on flying saucers and visited planets and have, you know, and having had, shall we say, very intimate relationships with aliens and so forth. Yeah. So all of the, you know, so how does a space clam, you know, compare to some guy that says he was sleeping with a 8-foot-tall woman from Venus or something? You know, it just, yeah. just doesn't capture the same attention at the time. But, you know, in hindsight, we can look at it and say, wow, you know, this is, I'd love to know more about the case. You know, I'd love to know the exact location and so forth. But of course, you know, this is a very long time ago at this point. So there's a very limited amount that we can pursue.
Yeah, I think, yeah, there's definitely a cultural aspect to the 50s where there's a lot of sexy aliens visiting Earth and choosing a variety of lucky men from around the globe, I think. And it's something that you notice in science fiction films at the time as well. There's a lot of that goes on in that as well.
Oh, sure. Yeah, absolutely. And then, you know, you have to bear in mind other aspects, of course, that influence people's experience of the time and how that's reflected in even UFO literature. So you read a lot of that stuff from the old contactee movements and stuff about the Space Brothers and everything. It has a very socialist bent. Mm. And of course, you know, we're looking at the period of the Cold War and, you know, after World War II, when there were boom times, but at the same time, there were all these other things that crept in eventually, like the Red Scare and so forth. Yeah, and, you know, people were really looking for something, you know, something to latch onto. So it's curious because we rolled out of that little subculture of the contactee movement. And then, of course, eventually into the 60s, where we had people exploring, you know, the occult and altered states of consciousness and of course, LSD and things like that.
Yeah, very much so. It is. Yeah, I've never really kind of seen that train of thought, but yeah, it seems to have moved from that kind of contactee to a kind of transcendental experience, you know, especially with people like Leary and the like, with their promotion of the benefits of LSD and the places it could take you and the way it could open your mind and allow the third eye to shine out and things like that. It is quite odd how it. Yeah, there does seem to be some kind of cultural attachment to how it affects the kind of paranormal and Fortean aspect.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, if you look at the deeper aspects of the contactee movement, a lot of it was they didn't specifically necessarily use the term altered consciousness, but they were talking about things like, you know, how the space aliens would help us, you know, reach enlightenment and you know, find peace and all these types of things. So it's this weird sort of transition from, you know, the fears of us having used a nuclear bomb. And of course, there was still a lot of fear that there was going to be a war with Russia and the entire planet was going to be wiped out. But then also, you know, looking towards something to raise the consciousness, so to speak. And that's a lot of the subtext in those early accounts and you know, the different people who claim that they were in contact with these aliens who were so much more enlightened and ascended than us. Mm. You know, and you hear these various reasons that they came to begin with. Oh, they came because you know, they knew about the nuclear bomb, or they don't want us to wipe out the planet, and, you know, we're going to be part of the Galactic Federation now, and all of these things. So, you know, you see these constant trends. I think there's always a subculture within our society, it seems, that seeks these things out, seeks out transformation in some way. You can really trace it pretty far back through history in different periods, and even in modern times. You know, you had the contactee movement, and then, of course, the movement in the 60s that turned to drugs. But then, you know, you go to the 1980s and you have the whole New Age movement.
Yeah.
And, you know, that wrapped in all kinds of stuff, you know, from UFOs to Native American lore and you know, a whole range of things. And then it became all about, oh, we're going to raise our vibration. We're going to open all of our chakras. We're going to, you know, we're going to go to the New Age. The world is going to be reborn and so on and so forth.
Mm, yeah, very much so. Yeah, it is. It is. They seem to go hand in hand, though. Sometimes it's difficult to see which facet of that influences the other and vice versa, I think, David.
Yeah, because it's all so wrapped together. Mm. And, you know, that kind of goes back to my point earlier about taking a holistic approach to things. You know, I think it's important to look at the cultural dynamics and aspects that are going on, both on a regional level and on a larger scale when you're examining cases, and as well as going backwards and looking at history and folklore and how they influence current trends in sightings and encounters.
Yeah, very much so. I think in that kind of aspect, it is often interesting how certain stories or creatures capture the zeitgeist. And probably the one that's been with us probably the vast majority of the 20th century and has continued unabated till this day is obviously Bigfoot and Sasquatch. And I think for a fan of that particular niche subject, I'm always surprised when people who perhaps are interested in Bigfoot but don't know too much about it, they always seem extremely surprised when they come across stories from the south of the US, because I think from anybody outside of the Americas, they tend to consider Bigfoot as more northwestern and Canadian. But there's a whole realm of interactions and experiences and witnesses who claim to have seen a variety of creatures in both of the states.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, it's pretty fascinating, you know, to uncover some of those accounts. And even with a lot of researchers here in the States, Paul, you know, I have to sort of prove the point, if you will, that, no, there are a lot of accounts from the Southwest of the United States. And most people, when you say, oh, the Southwest, and you mentioned, you know, a state in particular, if you say Arizona or Nevada, you know, New Mexico, any of them in this region, the automatic image that is conjured in people's minds is just a flat desert full of cactus.
Yeah.
And that's not the reality. Mm. It really isn't. There's a diverse range of landscape and in different terrain and everything in both the states. And there are some very surprising things about Nevada. Even when I lecture on the topic, it's kind of curious. You know, you see some eyebrows sort of raise when I point out the facts. For instance, most people don't realize Nevada is the most mountainous state in the contiguous 48. Mm. It has more mountain ranges and, you know, it has a lot of very high elevation. The northern part of the state has a lot of rugged terrain and forests and really unexplored territory, essentially. You know, the population of Nevada, most of it is concentrated around the major cities, of course, Las Vegas being the main one, and then, you know, Reno and a few smaller areas. But gosh, there's such a range. You know, there's Lake Tahoe in Nevada, which is an alpine lake. And it's high elevation. It's beautiful forest around it, and there's a lot of potential for these creatures to sort of be hiding out. And, you know, I don't advocate that there are tons of sightings in the state, but there are certainly enough to make it a very fascinating topic.
Yeah, very much so. And once again, it's, you know, testament to the research that you do when you do your books. There's a hell of a lot of sightings that kind of spring up in the sort of mid 19th century, and it seems to have progressed from there, obviously, with the advent of people moving to those areas and local papers starting up. And it just seems that they just seem to have crossed over once people had sort of moved out there, that these stories suddenly began near enough as soon as people were around. It was if it started as soon as the papers became published.
That's pretty much the case, yeah. And, you know, I always delve into the historical aspects through papers and so forth. And In the United States, that's sort of a two-edged sword. You have to be very careful uncovering that stuff because, of course, the early days of newspaper reporting in this country, shall we say, was very creative at times. And, you know, the reporters, of course, had no qualms about making up bizarre stories. And, you know, at the same time, there are points of interest there that you – as a researcher, that I have to dig out and say, okay, well, this, you know, this is what was reported. The curious thing that happens sometimes is that some of those accounts will dovetail into areas where there have been modern sightings. And that's where it gets really fascinating. And then even more so when you go backwards from those early papers and you talk to Native American elders and you start learning about some of their cultural traditions and their lore about strange creatures that live in the region. So, you know, these are creatures that purportedly have been in the area for a very, very long time, you know, essentially since early tribal history. So at what point does someone say, okay, well, you know, here's smoke. Is there really fire?
Yeah, very true. I mean, it's one of those things as well, because there's a lot of reports in that kind of era of wild men running amok in certain states, especially in the Southwest region. There tends to be a not particularly a trend, and it's interesting. Look, when we look back at those stories, as you say, there's a lot of artistic license in some of these older stories. I think, to put it politely. But they seem to be, you know, what we would describe these days as Bigfoot, really.
Right. Yeah, exactly. And, you know, I think that you have to account for some of those reports anyway, probably being, you know, anomalous enough that we can say, okay, well, yeah, this person's saw something, you know. You sort of get a sense when you read a lot of those reports, what is complete fabrication and what has possibly a grain of truth. And those are the ones that get really interesting. And like I said, especially when they coincide with areas that have modern sightings going on.
Yeah, yeah. It's as if that gives it a bit more credence. And you know, with the greatest of respect, some of the witnesses. I mean, I've always been fascinated when a witness will always describe themselves at the beginning of telling of an experience. I was a complete skeptic, thought it was all nonsense, and it had whatever happened to them has completely changed their perception of both the reality of such creatures, but also how they see themselves in that environment as well.
Right. And I hear those comments a lot, you know, whether I'm investigating haunted locations or cryptid encounters or whatnot. Mm. And it does always lend a different air to the account when someone, you know, prefaces their story in that manner, because then you say, oh, okay. And then when you can sort of verify that through other sources, you know, their friends and associates and so forth, you really know that something genuine did happen to this person to alter their perceptions like that.
Yeah. I mean, it is something. I mean, I always give certain witnesses great credit because of the negative connotations of coming forward with any story that's slightly peculiar and doesn't fit inside any sort of explainable category. I find it fascinating that, I mean, often people say, oh, well, they're just doing it for the money. And I think, well, you clearly don't know that much about the subject because the vast majority of these people just get harassed to death.
Right. Right. Now, you know, admittedly, it has changed quite a bit in recent years. Mm. Because, you know, I have a joke that I always tell people, you know, that when I started in this field, if I went to a party and told people what I did, I was guaranteed a nice quiet evening alone. Because, you know, as soon as you start asking those questions, everybody's like, yeah, you know, stay away from that guy who's asking about ghosts and Bigfoot and, you know, all these things. But these days, it's sort of the opposite. If I, you know, if I go to a party and tell people what I do, there's a queue out the door because everyone has a story. Mm. You know, whether it's a strange light they saw in the sky, or oh, I think my Aunt Matilda visited me, you know, after she was dead, and all these types of things. So it really has in some ways become ingrained in pop culture, you know, partially because of all the television shows and the popularity of shows like Ghost Hunters and Finding Bigfoot. But at the same time, there are very large portions of the population that are hesitant to talk about such things, especially if they have any kind of position of, you know, authority such as law enforcement or, you know, certain standings in their neighborhood or their city or whatever. So there always is such a reluctance to some people. And, you know, you sort of pay attention to that when you're listening to these cases. And, you know, admittedly, yeah, there are a lot of people who are quote, telling their tales, hoping to get on television or, you know, to get their 15 minutes of fame. But there are still a lot of people who genuinely have a lot to lose if they come forward with their accounts. And, you know, they do so anyway because they absolutely believe that they experienced something strange. And very often it's nothing to do with money. It's that they're simply looking for answers. You know, I have a lot of people that contact me and they say, you know, I just want to understand what this was, you know, what I experienced, what, you know, what this is it really out there?
Yeah. I mean, that's often something that I always admire about some of these people is their honesty about what it's done to them. I was listening to Into the Fray this week, and Shannon interviewed a gentleman who had an experience with a Bigfoot, and he's basically just said, right, I never go out hiking on my own ever again, ever. And he was out all the time. And I've heard that from so many experienced outdoorsmen in the States, that when something like that happens to them, that's it. They never go anywhere on their own.
Right. Yeah. You know, I've talked to hunters. You know, I talked to a hunter at one point last year. This guy had grown up, you know, hunting with his father and had hunted for, I don't know, 30 years or something, and never had a single strange thing occur like that. But, you know, lo and behold, one day he was out hunting and he encountered what he now firmly believes was a Sasquatch, and he stopped hunting. He won't go out there anymore. He was terrified by the experience, and the idea that here's this massive creature that was out there the whole time, you know, and of course the human consciousness conjures all kinds of things. You know, it's like, oh, this, you know, has this thing been watching me every time I'm out there? You know, what does it want? You know what? When's it going to decide I'm lunch? You know, it's all these different things. Fine. And, you know, he gave it all up.
Yeah. I think it's quite interesting that the way that affects people as well, David, because, you know, we can be brutally honest. There are very few stories about anybody having an aggressive, you know, sort of experience with such creatures. I know there are, you know, several well-known. Ape Canyon is probably the most well-known story in regards to an aggressive Bigfoots and such like. But it seems peculiar how it emotionally affects these people.
Absolutely, yeah. The accounts of aggressive Bigfoot-like creatures, that is pretty rare, you know, in modern times anyway. Certainly if we go back to some of the older folklore, which I delve into in the books, there is some evidence of that that's possibly, you know, Sasquatch type creatures. But for the most part in modern times, no, there's very rarely anything that's confrontational like that. And in fact, you know, there are occasions where people will hear what they describe as sort of an aggressive vocalization, but it seems more as if they're trying to use that to intimidate and to get the person out of their area. There's also some curious cases that sound like these creatures are using infrasound to sort of, you know, clear people out of their neighborhood, so to speak. So, you know, I don't think something of that size, you know, if it wanted to take down humans, it would be doing so, you know.
But it doesn't seem to have any genuine interest. It seems to more want to be left alone. But you do bring up an interesting point when you talk about the emotional impact that a lot of these people experience. And again, you know, going back to the whole thing with the hunter, it was very curious because I mean, this guy was so shaken. He was really shaken to his core. And this was well past the experience that he was telling me about. If I recall correctly, it was like 2 years previous that he had had the experience and hadn't been back in the woods since then himself. But when he told the story, you could see the emotional impact that still affected him. And, you know, there are other accounts of people. There are accounts of people out hunting and putting one of these creatures in the gun sights and then having a very sort of traumatic or disturbing experience. You know, there are some people I've talked to who raise their rifle and have this thing in the scope. And, you know, the next thing they remember, they're just sort of standing there and the rifle's leaning against a tree.
Yeah.
So, you know, they sort of lose a little bit of time or memory right there. And that could be infrasound affecting them. But there are other people who said that, you know, they've looked at these things closely. And I find this interesting. There are people who say they've looked at these creatures closely and have been disturbed by how human it is.
Yes.
Now, that I think in some ways sort of gets into the whole religious dynamic because, you know, I recall speaking to a man who was a very devout Christian who saw one of these things while out on a hike, and he just couldn't really fit it into his paradigm. You know, he just, you know, his statement was something to the effect of that can't be something of God, but it looks so human. I just don't understand. You know, so they're left with this dilemma of where to place that within the paradigm of their belief system and their life.
Yeah. Well, I think I don't think that necessarily would. I think that aspect should affect anybody, really, David, regardless of whether you're a devoutly religious man or a dogmatic scientist, because regardless, that doesn't fit into what you know at all.
Well, for most people, I think, yeah. It doesn't fit into religion, and it doesn't fit into, quote, accepted science currently, yes. Certainly. But, you know, there's absolutely a growing number of people that, you know, have no qualms about saying, oh, yeah, I absolutely know that they're out there.
Yeah. I think, like as you refer to, I think one of the things I've been struck by when I've heard hunters say that they get one in their sights is for a lot of them, it's when they see the creature's eyes and they just say, it just looked human.
Yes. Yes.
And therefore, like you say, sometimes they lower the gun or the next thing, they're not really sure what's gone on, but the gun's by the side, the creature's gone, and they're just stood there thinking, hello, what's happened here? So, yeah, it does seem to create a whole different kind of range of emotions, but essentially, most people tend to have an experience where it just changes their opinion and that's that.
It does. And, you know, of course, a lot of people are sort of in the middle ground, so to speak, in modern times, because they're aware of the reports. You know, they're probably aware of the television shows. Maybe they've seen some of them, but they sort of casually discard it as, oh, that's a crazy notion. You know, wow. But it's not deeply ingrained in their consciousness that these things do or do not exist. And then all of a sudden, boom, there's one in front of them. And it really shakes their way of thinking up.
Yeah, I mean, one of the stories that you mention in the book, and there's numerous stories in dealing with large cryptids that seem to match this from around the world. It reminded me of a Yowie sighting more than anything, which was the motorcyclist who was driving through the desert at night. And just captures something enormous in his headlight that just he was at. I mean, the police say when you cover the story, the police say it was clearly obvious he was very shaken by what happened to him.
Right. Yeah, that's an older report, and you know, it was unfortunately it's very brief. I tried to dig in and find some more information about that account, but I couldn't locate anything else. It it was one of those things that, you know, he reported it to the authorities. And of course, you know, they put a lot of weight on the encounter simply because of how traumatized the man seemed. And we have quite a few of those actually in the Southwest. There are some accounts from over in Arizona, in northern Arizona, around the Flagstaff area, which is a university town. And there were reports there that college students, you know, issued. And the authorities at the time, you know, there were a few in the 70s that were reported. And the authorities at the time, their initial reaction was, oh, geez, you know, we got a couple of college students are probably out drinking, or, you know, or they're trying to pull a hoax or whatever. But then when they start interviewing these young people and listening to the story, it becomes very clear that, no, these people saw something, they experienced something, and it's really shaken them up. And those accounts, you know, some of the reports, you just you know, they're unfortunately scant, but at the same time, you're like, wow, you know, to have been in that area at the time, you know, to have, you know, for me, I think, wow, if I would have been able to interview those people at the time or go to the location or so forth, of course, that's, you know, well past the point now. But, you know, some of these encounters, they're just so dynamic and puzzling at the same time that you just sort of go over them again and again as a researcher and investigator. One of my favorites, actually, Paul, is from Nevada, from the nuclear test site.
Yes.
And, you know, that is such a again, that's one that I read every detail I could find and was just so fascinated by it. Now, for those who aren't familiar with it, the Nevada test site is the area in the States where they tested nuclear bombs. And
the Nevada test site is about 65 miles outside of Las Vegas, Nevada. And this is the area that in the 1950s, they were actively testing nuclear bombs. And this is a strange thing to look at in hindsight, because, you know, people would have these viewing parties to watch the mushroom clouds and so forth. And of course, you know, modern times we think, oh my God, that's so absurd, you know, the dangers and so forth. But back then, you know, they'd all put their sunglasses on and watch the big cloud form over the desert and, you know, unaware of the dangers of the radiation and so forth. In modern times, this is still a secure site. The NTS, Nevada Test Site, is controlled by the government. You have to have special access, of course, to get on the site, and has a secure area. You know, there are military and government personnel there. And in January 1980, a man who was a driver was bringing some supplies to the Nevada Test Site when he spotted a Sasquatch strolling across the road leading into the control center. Yeah. So, of course, he reported this. He was a man who was very trusted and considered, you know, they didn't question his veracity or anything. And it was such a bizarre thing, you know. Oh, there's a Bigfoot strolling across the Nevada test site. So, you know, the story is that a couple of some security personnel were sent out to investigate the location and see if they could locate this creature. Now, there's one discrepancy in this report, and it's that some of the reports claim that they found absolutely nothing. There are some other scant reports that claim, no, they did see tracks that went across the road and off into the desert. But beyond that, the story got out. And Dave Jackson, who was the information officer of the NTS at the time, he was inundated with calls, because I guess it was a slow news week. You know, the idea of a Bigfoot, you know, roaming around the Nevada test site just caught the media's attention. So all these reporters and so forth, and he's getting all these phone calls. And as I said, he's kind of inundated and tells the story again and again, and got posted in the news and everything. Here's the kicker to the story. Jackson, you know, he fielded so many calls, he thought he'd heard it all. And he got a telephone call from a gentleman who asked him about the account and said, you're not going to believe what I'm about to tell you. And Jackson, of course, is kind of laughing to himself, thinking, you know, buddy, I've heard it all at this point.
Yeah.
But the gentleman on the other end of the phone says, well, whenever we have a Sasquatch sighting moving east, there's going to be an earthquake within 24 hours. Now, the gentleman was calling from California. And Jackson thinks, okay, now I probably have heard it all. You know, thank you for your time and so forth. But Jackson was not prepared for the fact that the following day there was an earthquake reported. So this is just such a bizarre ending to this story. You know, a Sasquatch roaming across a government facility heading away from California and, you know, beating a path for something. And, of course, as a researcher, you know, it brings all kinds of questions to mind because historically you do have all these instances where animals will leave the scene when there's a pending earthquake or tsunami and things like that. So, you know, did this creature indeed sense that something was coming and decided to beat a retreat out of the area and took off across the desert?
Absolutely. I mean, you refer to that. I mean, that's that, you know, obviously that chap, yeah, back then there was very little sort of evidence. It was quite a lot of anecdotal evidence about animals' reactions to the environment, you know, as if they could sense something was coming. But you know, as you refer to there, tsunamis, the Asian tsunami in 2004,
yes,
there were notable stories of animals' interaction, and one that sticks out in my mind was a young girl that was on she was riding a baby elephant on the beach in Thailand, and it ran off with her, and the family went, oh my god, and everybody's running. They ran about 3 miles chasing this elephant with a girl, and it ran to higher ground.
I remember that.
At the point that the earthquake, the tsunami hit, where they essentially, if they hadn't, this elephant hadn't run off, they'd all be dead.
Yeah.
And there, yeah, was notable stories, and obviously there's a lot of I know the Japanese have done a lot of tests in regards to this because obviously it's such a volatile part of the world around there, and they especially have noticed things like salamanders and worms and birds tend to just disappear maybe an hour before something bad happens, which I think is right. But it's nice to see that gives a bit more credence to Bigfoot being, I don't know, that's a very weird facet of that particular experience, I think.
I think it is too. And, you know, for me, it's fascinating too, because it makes you wonder, you know, all these other animals and creatures sense these types of things. So, you know, what have humans lost touch with that is sort of a natural, you know, biological warning system or something. But, you know, in this case, this is pretty fascinating that here we have a creature that certainly appears to have gotten out of the way of a pending natural disaster.
Absolutely. And that could open another can of worms about the famous St. Helens incident as well. Because obviously that's supposed to be, you know, that unfortunately some didn't get out of the way of the eruption up there.
Right.
Yeah. But, I mean, that certainly gives it a bit more credence. And also, it's a very, you know, I would imagine that entire area is extremely uninhabited. So, for all we know, it would be quite comfortable there, because it the chances of it meeting a person in such a restricted area are virtually nil.
Oh, yes. I mean, you're talking about, you know, some pretty bleak landscape. Of course, you know, the Vegas metro area is pretty big, but you don't have to travel very far to get out into the desert where there's just not a lot of people. Ooh. And, you know, this, of course, this whole region we're talking about, you've got the Nevada test site, then you've got, you know, Area 51. You have a couple of small communities here and there, but for the most part, there's just not a whole lot of people wandering around. And, you know, if the creature's anxiously getting away from something, I think it's going to take the route that is going to get it away as quickly as possible with as little interaction as possible, because these things do seem to make a conscious attempt to avoid, you know, large populations for the most part. If they do intrude upon cities and so forth, it's, you know, it's for food and other resources. And they seem to try to do so in a very covert manner, shall we say, you know, late at night and so forth.
Yeah, I mean, is that something you've come across in your research over the years, David? Have you found anything a similar kind of story in regards to that kind of person giving that sort of train of thought to why the Bigfoot was moving across. Is it something else you've been able to uncover at all?
No, you know, that's the most significant one, surely. And, you know, there's a few other scattered accounts here and there of creatures that seem to be getting out of the way, you know, Sasquatch-like creatures that seem to be really beating a retreat for some reason. But, you know, we have a lot of accounts of purportedly these creatures being caught like the St. Helens eruption that you mentioned. You know, there's another famous story in Nevada called Battle Mountain. But it really more folklore at this point. I cover it in the book because it's so it's been mostly a hoax, although there are still a few researchers that think there's some validity to it. But that involves a Sasquatch that was supposedly caught in a forest fire in the region. I don't really do too much of that type of thing, but, you know, I don't think that people necessarily always put the pieces together. You know, if you had a strange encounter and saw a Sasquatch, you wouldn't necessarily think to connect it with, oh, well, there was an earthquake in the neighboring state next day. Mm. I don't think most people would really account for that.
Yeah, very much so. I mean, like you say, the Battle Mountain case is extremely odd because it opens up a whole can of worms in regards to it being a cover-up, shady people, statements being forced out of people. I know the chap said, you know, when he was giving the reasons, he basically lists the conditions that everybody has to sign after this particular incident. And obviously one of the key things that stood out there for me was the fact it would be complete loss of benefits and pension.
Right. Yeah, I mean, it's certainly a fascinating story. I personally don't I don't put a lot of stock in it. You know, even though I'm fascinated by the various aspects of it and the potential for something like that having happened, you know, it's sort of interesting to look at in light of the fact that this whole FBI release, you know, this week that I'm sure you've seen in the news that, you know, the FBI admits that it had, you know, research on Sasquatch or documents on Sasquatch and so forth. But the Battle Mountain case was pretty. Pretty thoroughly looked over by the BFRO and some other independent researchers. Mm-hmm. And, you know, most people think, it's just, you know, it was somebody trying to hoax the situation, but you just don't know. You just don't know. And, you know, as I said, there are a couple of researchers that think that, no, it really did happen. And there's a conspiracy that went on to cover this up and hide the facts of what really went down. Of course, without access, direct access to the purported witness, then there's not really very far you can go with it.
Yeah, very much so. I mean, it is a very unusual story, and like you say, I think it's one of those. It just seems too fantastical, and I think it really is stretching credence to imagine so many people. I mean, it's one of those things that so many people to be involved in something like that, surely it would leak out. I think that was the thing I took from reading that particular part of the book, David.
Oh yeah, absolutely. And for those who are not familiar with the story, the Reader's Digest version of it is that it involved a fire that took place on Battle Mountain, and supposedly a Sasquatch wandered into the area where these firefighters were battling the blaze. It was very injured. There were paramedics on hand and you know, other professionals, and they started treating this thing and trying to save its life. Essentially, it had severe burns, and the conspiracy is that the body was taken away, you know, by government officials, and that everyone was forced to be silent about the issue. But, you know, as you point out, Paul, you're talking about a lot of people, and over time, you know, there will certainly be more than one witness who came forward to say that this happened, I believe. I don't think something that fantastical occurring, I don't think you could keep everyone shut up, because, you're not talking about a small core group of military people. You're talking about a range of, you know, different personnel, from firefighters to, you know, the guy driving the ambulance. So, somebody else is going to have to tell the story.
Absolutely. So. Yeah, very much so. There's no deathbed confession as yet, for, which tends to prop up as well, which we've come across. I mean, it is strange how it affects both states as well, that they both, you know, would be traditionally, as I referred to earlier, not considered as hotspots. But, you know, it's the same in Arizona as well as Nevada. There's, you know, there's a rich history of it.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, again, Arizona, people automatically think, oh, you know, flatland and big saguaro cactus. And it's just simply not the case. If you look at the terrain of the state, the central part of Arizona, and, you know, most people again think Arizona, oh, it's all big saguaro cactus and flatland, but that's not at all the case. You have to bear in mind that the Grand Canyon is in Arizona. The central part of the state, pretty much dead center, there's a town called Payson, small, beautiful little town, pretty much is Bigfoot Central. It's in an area, the region is called the Mogollon Rim. Mm. And much of this is 5,000 feet in elevation. It is beautiful country, you know, lots of forests, lots of resources, small towns dotted here and there, and lots of encounters with a creature that locally in that region is called the Mogollon Monster. When you listen to the story, essentially you're hearing Bigfoot accounts. And one of the differences, it's a little bit contradictory to what we were talking about earlier, is that a lot of the Mogollon Monster accounts, these creatures in this particular area tend to be a little bit more aggressive. You hear a lot more accounts of rock throwing, of them sort of chasing people out of their areas, and, you know, not wanting intruders in their region and so forth. But it's funny because, you know, I first heard about this creature, you know, oh gosh, back in the, I think it was the early 90s, I was in Arizona, and I was in a local watering hole. And, you know, this is back what I call PG era, you know, pre-Google. You couldn't just, you know, quickly Google, you know, sightings. You actually had to talk to people. That's a novel idea to a lot of modern researchers. But one of the best resources is always to go into a small area and hang out at the bar, you know, and start talking. And that's what I was doing. I was hanging out and talking to people, and heard a pretty interesting UFO encounter from a young man who was in there. And, you know, this is the region where the Travis Walton abduction took place, one of the most famous UFO cases, not far from right there. And after this gentleman, you know, he and I talked for a little bit, and he left the bar, and here's this old timer sitting in there having his drink, and he's like, nah, he says, UFO, they're flying saucers and aliens, all that's nonsense. But I tell you what is real, the Mogollon Monster. And of course, that caught my attention. I was like, "Oh, let me buy you a drink, sir." You know, he proceeded to tell me about the sightings of this creature that dated easily back to the 1940s, but really before, as I dug in later times and found older accounts. The Native Americans in the region again have a long history of talking about these strange creatures on their tribal lands and all around the state. And these Sasquatch-like creatures are still reported very frequently today in a lot of these central Arizona small towns. You know, Payson, as I said, is a hotspot. Prescott, Sedona even, just a lot of these areas. And you hear some amazing accounts. And there's one that I discussed in the book, and I'm currently trying to pursue some more details on it. There's a gentleman who lives outside of Prescott, has a farm, and has sheep. Now, his family, they have a nice little piece of land. They have had a family dog that had been with them for 10 years, never strayed far from the property. It was a good guard dog, kept the coyotes and so forth off the property because they wouldn't intrude with the dog there. One day the dog disappeared, and the family, of course, obviously was quite upset. You know, the family pet is gone missing. Well, the gentleman's son found the dog a couple days later up in a tree. Remember, that it's just somewhere between 10 and 14 feet up in a tree with its neck broken, draped over some branches. Yeah. No other marks on this dog. The first assumption is, well, maybe, you know, a big cat, because there are occasional mountain lions and cougars in the area, but no signs of anything else on this dog, just as if something had picked it up, broken its neck, and draped it over these branches high up in the trees. So right after that, sheep started disappearing. And, you know, there were some other anomalous reports. You know, they were hearing these strange howls and different sounds in the woods around the farm. So, you know, the implication is that one of these Bigfoot-like creatures was eyeing those sheep and was annoyed at the guard dog that was constantly making noise whenever it was near. So decided to eliminate the alarm, so to speak.
Absolutely. I mean, there have been certain reports of interactions with Bigfoot type creatures where dogs have had their necks broken. I can think of several cases as well as a couple of witnesses who've seen allegedly seen Bigfoot do that to pigs and sheep.
Yes.
So, yeah, I mean, yes, that shows a level of intelligence, because obviously, you know, that once again gives credence to the fact that they're not just, you know, monosyllabic creatures that eke out an existence. They're clever, they're intelligent, and they know what they can do.
Oh, absolutely. And they know what's the threat and what they need to eliminate in order to have easier access to their prey and so forth. And, you know, it's fascinating, because the natives in the southwest region of the United States, of course, view these creatures as a sort of another tribe, a different set of beings that really just should be left alone. And, you know, there are legends all over the southwest of tribes battling these creatures in the past and having conflict with them, but at some point coming to a sort of resolution and saying, all right, well, we'll leave, you know, you leave us alone and we'll leave you alone.
Yeah.
So there's sort of a quiet acceptance on their part that, yes, these creatures are out there, but, yeah, you better leave them alone.
Yeah, very much so. And once again, that kind of backs up why some people have such an emotive response to seeing them, because, you know, when we think about it, a chimp can easily kill a man if it's that way out, you know. And we're probably talking about one of the smaller apes, you know, monkeys in general.
Right.
So when you're in the, you know, gorillas are just incredibly strong. And when you're talking about something that dwarfs a gorilla, you know, you're in the realms of, you've no idea what the possible outcome could possibly be here.
Right, because you're talking about a massive amount of power all of a sudden.
Well, exactly. And you've got to be, you know, clearly you are top of the food chain, because, you know, in the American wilds, you have some pretty large predators out there that can take down near enough anything, you know, especially bears.
Right.
You know, technically the bear would be the top predator, because, you know, nothing can really mess with a bear on land, on any continent, sadly. So for them to be confident enough to exist, once again, gives credence to the power and strength of such creatures.
Absolutely. And then combined with the intelligence that they seem to have, you're talking about something that is very, very dangerous.
Mm. Yeah. Which is, once again, I think that tends to show a more intellectual response to human interaction from their point of view, because we don't have, you know, as we referred to earlier, there are very few sort of aggressive interactions. So that, for me, probably gives credence, you know, as you were referring to, that at the end of the day, they just want to be left alone more than anything.
Yeah, I do think that's the case. And when you look at these accounts, you know, they seem to make every effort
to avoid interactions for the most part with people. And that's sort of, you know, that's if we set aside the whole, what a lot of people refer to as the woo factor, you know, the people who say they're in telepathic communication with, but you know, again, that sort of brings us full circle, doesn't it, Paul? Because we're back to this whole idea of the Space Brothers, you know, and sort of the modern interpretation is, oh, the Harry brothers, you know, who live in the forest and are going to teach us to be peaceful and all these different things. And, yeah, they're 8 feet tall and they can snap my neck, you know, but they just want to be left alone and paint rocks or whatever, you know, whatever they're doing. So it's kind of a fascinating and curious take on, you know, whatever these people are experiencing, you know, and again, you know, who are we to judge necessarily? Because, well, you know, we're not there when this guy says that he's had this conscious interaction with these creatures. So at the end of the day, you know, who knows until there's further evidence.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, it's quite interesting. I think the other key cryptid that both states seem to share is Thunderbirds, or a version thereof. And I've always found these stories incredibly fascinating, primarily because we know giant birds of that nature existed.
Right.
So for me, it's never beyond the realms of possibility that it could still survive, because we've still got some fairly large birds out there. You know, as you mentioned in the book, the Californian condor, for example. I mean, there are still the possibilities of, you know, as you refer to these states, they've got some pretty remote locations with zero populations in some of them. It's not beyond the realms of possibility at all that there could be surviving species of such birds.
Yeah, it's certainly possible. It is a fascinating topic. And, you know, quite honestly, when I really delved into the stuff from Nevada, for instance, I was kind of surprised that I didn't find more of those sightings. And, you know, the same really is, in a sense, is true with Arizona, although there are more. And of course, Arizona is also the location of the famous or infamous Thunderbird photograph. That is probably one of the biggest mysteries in cryptozoology at this point. Mm. And, you know, you start examining that and you really kind of go down the rabbit hole with the potentials and the possibilities. But at the least, we do have some curious accounts. There's native lore in Nevada about the Ong, primarily, that's up around Lake Tahoe, a giant bird that supposedly lived in the water itself. And then you get down into Arizona and you have even more recent things. You have the legend of the Thunderbird in southern Arizona. And you have some other anomalous reports here and there of people seeing these winged creatures that, you know, often are described as something out of the dinosaur era.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, you can't help but be fascinated by that type of thing. You know, somebody comes to you and says they saw a living dinosaur. I mean, I'm kind of all ears. I want to know. Okay, I definitely want to hear more about this. But, you know, who knows? Such a vast landscape and so much territory that there's – I firmly believe there are a lot of creatures out there that we just haven't discovered or rediscovered yet at this point.
Yeah. It's one of those frustrations, I think, for anybody who's into cryptozoology or the search for unknown creatures, that large creatures keep popping up. We keep certain, you know, if you look at mainstream, there is a tendency to kind of say, we've discovered everything we can. There are no large creatures left to discover on the planet whatsoever. In the sea is a different kettle of fish, because I think there's all kinds of strange things down there that we're not aware of. But there are still, you know, there is currently some studies going on out in far eastern Asia, in Thailand and Cambodia and countries like that. They're finding new species of deer that they've never come across before. You know, large lizards, large snakes.
All the time.
I mean, I don't understand why certain people go, yeah, that's it, we've discovered it. When the evidence is clearly doesn't support that point of view, David.
Well, I think a lot of that perception, Paul, comes from the fact that the majority of the populace lives in cities. Mm. And, you know, I get asked all the time, you know, why, if you have someone who's of a more skeptical mindset, you know, they say, well, I just don't believe Bigfoot could be out there because we've explored everything. We would know it's there. And, you know, a great example in the United States is the state of Utah. You know, it's a very large western state. And I'll show people on a map. I'll say, look carefully at this state. There is a major intersection that cuts right up the middle of the state. And there's another one that crosses it in the northern portion of the state. Mm-hmm. Now, the bulk of the population in Utah lives along those corridors. Mm-hmm. You know, they're either, you know, they're because all the cities are just off the interstates. Mm-hmm. So when you consider that, yeah, there's a lot of people in the state, but wait a minute, they all live, you know, basically along these corridors. There are certainly, you know, small towns here and there in the country, but you're still talking about vast tracts of land that, you know, I'm convinced, I know there's land out there that hasn't seen, you know, human footprints since maybe the early, Native Americans or something. I mean, it's just, it's not like, you know, all of these woods are being tromped by humans every day. You know, the average person, they're used to, you know, driving across town or walking down the street to their coffee shop or whatever every day. And they think, oh, I've seen everything along this route. You know, I know what's here. You can't apply that to the wilderness. You just can't. And I don't think that people have this understanding and this full realization of how much vast, dense, unexplored territory there is out there that just does not see human contact on a regular basis. So, you know, and let's face it, most people don't go out into the wilderness, you know, whether it's the woods of the desert or anything else. They just don't. Mm. And even the people that do, for the most part, it's very limited because what do? They go out to hiking trails or biking trails and things like that. Yeah. Again, areas that see frequent human activity. So, you know, there's certainly, you know, I encourage people just, you know, take a little time, you know, look at the trusty Google and look at the, you know, look at the maps and the terrain and so forth and see how much is out there that we just don't know what's there.
Yeah, I think that's I think that's a very good point you make there, David, that yes, some of these people that do go out there into these wilderness areas. Yeah, it's good to be out there, but they are on known paths and known trails. They're not exploring off trail, as it were. I mean, obviously, in certain areas, that's just not the dumb thing to do because you've no idea what's underfoot.
Right.
But you can be on a trail in the middle of nowhere, but either side of where that path is probably hasn't been explored for centuries.
That's right. That's right.
I mean, yeah. So, I mean, the Thunderbird sighting that caught my eye in this one, and obviously it's in the news, obviously, this week because the new Small Town Monsters film's out, which is covering Terror in the Skies, which is dealing with flying cryptids of a variety of things. But the one about the lady who's in the car driving back and she sees some kind of giant eagle in a ditch.
Oh, right. Yeah.
And obviously she's terrified because she can understand how deep, she knows how deep that ditch is, and she can see still how tall this creature is.
Right, right. And there's several of those. And, you know, what's funny, Paul, is that the Thunderbirds, you know, it is fascinating. And as an investigator, this is one of those things that sort of nags at you because it's not an isolated account like the space clams, for instance.
Yep.
There are just enough of these accounts to really leave you scratching your head and wondering, you know, what in the heck? You know, why we don't just have one. We have, I don't know, you know, a few dozen here and there throughout time. And you have to just puzzle over why does someone in, you know, this state and then way over in this state 10 years later or prior see a similar creature? You know, what exactly is happening here? And again, you know, these are people with nothing to gain, you know, not trying to make a buck off the sighting or anything like that. But they're describing creatures often, as I said, that look like something out of the dinosaur era. Mm. If you look at the painting on the front of Compensate Monsters, mm. which is a UK artist, Sam Sharon, fantastic artist.
Fabulous.
You know, he did an amazing job of depicting this thing, and this is the creature that was essentially described in Tombstone in the famous encounter.
Yep.
You know, this giant winged, leathery winged creature with an elongated head and a long tail. And, you know, in modern times, we occasionally have these accounts where people are seeing these things. You know, sometimes there was one in Sedona, Arizona, you know, where the people saw one of these things and they swear they saw this, you know, dinosaur-like flying creature in the region, and absolutely no reason for them to just make this up. And how, you know, and then it's one of those things, how do you mistake something like that? Okay, they swear there were no feathers.
Mm.
Well, now we're in a different spectrum because we're not talking about a large bird that someone, you know, things in the sky are very hard for people to gauge in terms of size.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think a lot of the Thunderbird sightings, okay, well, you saw a bird. It was maybe one that's unusual for the region you're in, or maybe you just haven't seen one before.
Hmm.
You've seen, you know, an eagle or a crane or something like that.
Yeah.
It's high in the sky, and you have no, you know, nothing to compare it to in terms of size. You know, it's not on the ground, so you're not able to judge its size in accordance with trees or rocks or anything nearby.
Hmm.
And there's this perception, you know, people tend to make things larger in their mind than they really are, especially if it's something that's unusual. You know, this is like the old adage, you know, the fish that got away, right?
Yeah. Oh,
it's 12 feet long, you know. But, you know, the same thing happens when people see these creatures. You know, I saw this huge bird. I've never seen a bird this big. It was, you know, had 30-foot wingspan. You know?
Yeah.
You know, it was probably, you know, a large raven or something. But it was high in the sky, and it shocked them at the time. But, again, there's just enough of these accounts that sort of nag at us as investigators because, oh, here we have a woman who saw this giant winged thing down in a ditch. She had points of reference, you know. She could tell that this was something very unusual in size. How do you reconcile that? You know, what do you do with it? And, you know, Ken Gerhard's a good friend of mine, and we were talking about this exact point recently, you know, the fact that there are just enough of these large bird sightings to make it both annoying and fascinating at the same time, I guess.
Yeah, that's an interesting aspect to it, I think. And like you say, you know, when people are describing the living dinosaur type thing, the only creature currently that you could even draw a comparison to is a bat. But then, but that again, that doesn't make sense because they're not describing a creature that looks like a bat. In regards to the shape of the head, or the way it acts, it tends to act like a bird or a dinosaur or what we interpret a dinosaur would behave like, David.
Right.
But even the realms of possibility that even if you think, well, it wasn't a dinosaur, it's a bat. Well, then we're talking about a giant sized bat that we're simply not aware of existing.
Yeah.
I mean, that's possible explanation is perhaps as ludicrous as a living dinosaur.
Exactly. And, you know, when you get into that realm, you have a lot of other things, too, because, of course, bats are nocturnal. You know, bats have a very distinctive movement. You know, they usually fly very quickly. And, you know, a lot of these reports that people are reporting about these Thunderbirds, you know, oh, it had very large wings, you know, it flapped them kind of slowly, you know, I saw it gliding, you know, on these large wings. And again, you're getting into something that is so puzzling and so fascinating. And those are the ones that particularly fascinate me because as soon as they're reporting a giant wing thing with no feathers, then I sort of give it a little bit more of attention because you know, again, there are some large birds in this country, and I think people have difficulty in their perceptions of exactly how big something is,
yep.
You know, especially if they're not used to seeing eagles and cranes and things like that airborne. But when we're talking about a creature with no feathers and, you know, some of these other unusual aspects that they describe, you know, the elongated head and long tail and so forth, then it does move into an entirely different world. And as I said earlier, it kind of sends us down the rabbit hole, because what exactly is happening? You know, you want to branch out away from strict cryptozoology, you know, are people somehow seeing, you know, they're catching a glimpse of the past? You know, what exactly is happening?
Absolutely. And it is weird that it, you know, other than Mekele Mbembe in Africa, people aren't seeing T-Rexes running about everywhere or Diplodocuses or any other particular type of dinosaur. I mean, obviously, you could that's a different kettle of fish when it comes to lake monsters, of course. But
oh, yeah.
Why would that alone then says to, well, why have pterodactyls and pterodons and the like survived and others didn't then? Because they were all around at the same time. And like you say, even say, well, let's accept that it is a dinosaur. Well, where's the others? I mean, that's even strange. Like, oh, it's
exactly.
It is a rabbit hole that once you get down, there are so many tangents, you can end up anywhere, I think, on that one.
Absolutely.
And then, obviously, like you referred to there, you start thinking, well, perhaps is it a portal? Is it that kind of situation? And then you're like, oh, dear.
Right. Well, and that's kind of fascinating, too, because, you know, Keel referred to those as window zones. And, yep. You know, in my research, I've certainly found that there are areas of what I call high strangeness that have great concentrations of a wide range of strange manifestations. Mm. Curiously enough, a lot of times, those, if you go back in tribal lore in the region, will be areas that were considered taboo by the tribe, because they would say, no, there's that's not a good place to be. There are dark things that happen there. You know, there's a wide range of ways they interpret it, but they basically say, no, that's an area to stay out of, you know, because you might not come back. So, again, is that some kind of a strange crossing point, you know? And it's funny, Paul, because I've talked about this stuff for years. And, of course, you know, back in the day, a lot of people would just kind of shake their heads and say, you know, he probably needs meds or something. But but then, you know, we fast forward to modern times and we've got quantum physics talking about the reality of other dimensions, you know, other universes, you know, and quantum science, you know, they came out with this whole concept that there's 12 other dimensions. You know, we don't know how to get there, but we know they're there.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, that raises a lot of questions when we start looking at some of these mysteries, especially the more isolated ones like Thunderbirds.
Yeah, very much so. I mean, I think both books are absolutely fabulous. Just, you know, as I said at the beginning, David, for someone that's not had the opportunity to visit both states, I think they're both wonderful documents showing off the beauty of both states, as well as the rich variety of legends and monsters that are thought to inhabit them. Have you considered, you know, is this the start of a new ongoing project for you? Are you looking at perhaps expanding into a couple of other states going forward?
Oh, there'll be other states coming. Everybody's asked me that. And, you know, somebody sent me a message and said, what are you going to do, all 50 states? And I'm like, well, you know, I probably have enough in my files to do that. But it's just a matter of balancing it with other projects and so forth. But, yes, there will be some others coming, most definitely.
Excellent. Because what's the next book out for you? Is it I believe you're going back into the paranormal again for your next release. Is that correct?
Yeah, the next book should be out probably around the end of this month. It is called Eerie Companions, A History of Haunted Dolls. And goes on the whole track of dolls and their use in magic and ritual and, you know, throughout history and so forth. And then on into modern times with the whole range of these haunted dolls that everybody's fascinated by now, such as Annabelle and Robert.
Yeah. Have you had the privilege of meeting any of them?
I've met pretty much all of the main ones. There's one in Australia that's really well known. I haven't encountered yet. That's Letta. But most all of the main ones I've seen in person.
And how was your How was your meeting? Was it okay? Were you? Did it? Was it a positive experience for you?
Because I know I'm safe and sound. So.
Well, I'm glad to hear it.
I'm very fascinated by them, you know. Especially, I mean, the one that I find very compelling is Robert, simply because, you know, this is one of the older of the haunted dolls, and there's so many. There's such an incredible blend of folklore and stories and everything else surrounding him, and then of course a lot of modern accounts of people having problems from sort of disrespecting him. So, you know, you kind of go down the rabbit hole with that type of topic, because is this something that humans are creating, you know, within their own, you know, within their own field of belief, or is there something else, something more to the doll, the object itself, or have we just instilled so much energy in it that it does create an effect?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, that opens a variety of avenues, like, in regards to do we perhaps look back at things and with a kind of revisionism and attribute something going wrong due to perhaps an encounter with such a doll with a reputation such as Robert or Annabelle.
Right, because, you know, most people go in with a preconceived notion that it's you know, dark or sinister or whatnot. And, of course, you know, in modern times we have so many people that are afraid of dolls, you know, have that phobia. Mm. So that certainly adds a lot of weight to some of the experiences that people are having.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's such a wide topic as well, because it seems to be one of those things that's been with us as long as humans have practiced some kind of interaction. There's always been some kind of use of an effigy or a doll that obviously has developed through time and become more of a, you know, designed as a comforter in modern generations, perhaps, David.
But that's very modern. And that's one of the things that was fascinating about it, because, you know, really you go back in history and dolls were much more prominent as magical and ritual items, and, you know, people don't really understand that completely. So, you know, that's what I'm hoping to sort of get out there with this latest book that delves into that fully, the whole history of their use.
Marvelous. So the other favorite series of yours that I'm a massive fan of is your Woodnock series. So, I mean, what I loved about the whole premise of the Woodnocks is just the feeling of teamwork and collaborative investigation. The way you've brought these people all under one umbrella, as it is, David, I think is something you should be congratulated and applauded for. I just find them brilliant, because it's such a rich variety of opinion.
Well, thank you. I'm glad you enjoy the series. A lot of people seem to. The whole concept was to not just do a magazine with real light articles, but a journal so that people could go a bit more in depth. And, you know, there's a lot of things out there that it's fascinating. It's maybe not enough for an entire book in itself, but it certainly deserved to be out there somewhere. And that was my concept for the journal initially. And of course, to, you know, get a lot of my friends and so forth to be able to get some more material out there. And I've been very happy with the people that have contributed and just had, I feel, some amazing pieces that have been published in it so far. And Volume 4 is indeed in the pipeline.
Excellent. Will that be out before the end of this year, hopefully?
It should be, yes.
Ooh, fabulous. Yes. Well, I look forward to it. Because it was, I remember buying the first one and I just found it a brilliant, brilliant book. And it was really nice, because obviously being a Brit, it's nice to see that you've not ignored some of our writers as well, because obviously you got Nick Redfern in there, and obviously Richard Freeman, I'm a big fan of Richard's work on a variety of topics. So
yes,
I mean, it's good to see, and it's there are some people like Chris O'Brien who I'd known through his work through the animal mutilations, so it was good to see his take on situations like that. So was it something that you'd always planned, or was it just that one day you just thought, well, let's pull something together? Because it's quite unusual to have a book like that in this day and age at the minute.
I know, because so many people can't get along, right?
I'll let you say that, David.
No, I try to get along with everyone. I the idea, like I said, is to, you know, get the different voices out there and so forth. And, you know, it's something I thought about it for quite some time. I had the concept quite a few years ago and, you know, really wanted to do something like that. And just, I don't know, the timing was right at one point and I put the feelers out for the first volume to some good friends, Lyle Blackburn, mm-hmm. Ken Gehar, and a few other people. And the response was fairly quick, you know, and they all said, yeah, you know, I'll contribute something. And, you know, sort of rolled on from there. It's not always been an easy process, I can tell you, sort of, you know, wrangling in people that have a you know, busy schedules just like I do and, you know, limited time sometimes to write pieces. And, you know, I'm very blessed that people have responded to it and contributed what they have. I think that, you know, over the three volumes alone, there's just been some amazing work published in there. And I think that it will hopefully be something that serves researchers for a very long time to come.
Yeah. No, as I said, absolutely love it, me, and it's and all power to you, David, for bringing it together and continuing to push it forwards. It's marvellous. So, going forwards, where can everybody find your work, check you out online, and look forward to your next release?
Well, the books are all available at Amazon.com, and if you really want to keep up to me, there's a brand new website, actually, that launched about a month ago. It is eerielights.com, and that has everything you need on there. There's a news section, a page for events, because I appear quite frequently at events, and lots of other stuff on there. It's, I think, a very beautiful site and lots of information on there. So eerielights.com, please check it out. There's also an Eerie Lights Facebook page that has various news stories and so forth that get posted on there. And you can find Eerie Lights on Instagram. So all over social media, just check that out, eerielights.com.
Brilliant. Well, I mean, the only sad thing I've got to say is there is so much in both of the books that I could continue talking to you, David. Well, I mean, we've not even touched on Water Monsters or one of my favourites, the Shunka Warrican, but I will let you go now. hopefully we'll save that conversation for another day. So, listen, thank you so much for your time today. It's been an absolute pleasure. Best of luck with the new books. I recommend both of the State books highly. I can't recommend them more. From both introductions from Lyle and Ken, and obviously the fabulous artwork from Sam and your brilliant research and work. So all power to you. Thank you again, David. It's been an absolute pleasure, sir.
Thanks a lot, Paul. Have a good one.
You too. Bye-bye.